Hi, this is the Dark Tangent. The speech you're about to listen to was originally recorded at DEF CON 5 at the Aladdin Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada, 1997. Now all rights are reserved except permission for educational non-profit use. If you have any questions about DEF CON or the copyright status, contact me at dtangent@defcon.org or the website at www.defcon.org. Now kick back and relax.
Yo. How do you? I'm Hobbit. Bud should be along shortly. I guess I'll start with Adam, and then whenever he shows up, we can figure out what all we're going to talk about. CISN is Microsoft Network-type file sharing, in short. It encompasses a lot of other things. This is specifically about MC security, although it covers a lot of that, too, and it's where a lot of the most interesting bugs and features show up. I'm reachable by email, a small FTP site you might find useful. I want to straighten out some of the network protocols involved because there's still a lot of confusion about it. Describe the attack that the paper basically went over. And then we'll dive really far into the crypto. That's where money comes in a big way. And that's where it's going to explain a lot about LockCrack. And then we'll go over some of the things you can do to protect yourself. Other problems that relate to it that aren't necessarily SMB, and what things really need to be looked at in the future. There's a small clarification that needs to be made here. It's not all just Microsoft software. Some of the stuff grew up in the old manager environment. And a lot of it is still with us because Microsoft adopted it and is just still running the stuff. The original networking model was a peer-to-peer thing where any machine could share files with any other machine. And the model is more in a client server, but only because vendors want it to be. At any rate, in the early days, it was not designed in a robust fashion. It worked great in a small office, little LAN environment where you can see people throwing some files back and forth. And now it's being jammed into the much harsher environment of the internet, and it's just not ready. And meanwhile, the marketing engine keeps pushing it out there. So if you choose to run this stuff without taking additional protective measures, you're at serious risk. So, let's define some terms here. To back up a step, remember that NFS stands for Network File System in the Unix environment. It's a subset of the little procedure called transport mechanism. And it conforms to standardization in RFC for the IETF. The clients among us know that it means no file security. SMB was, I believe it was originally called shared message block because machines were sharing suspect and forms equally. And now Microsoft is calling it server message block. It's just as a slightly different way to think about it. It's the same thing. So CIFS, Common Internet File System, is what Microsoft and some other vendors want to become the NFS of the late 90s or something like that. It is a subset of the SMB transport. And it's also trying to become an IETF standard, but it's only in draft format these days. If you look at those drafts, you'll find that they're sloppily written, hard to read, and generally aren't ready for standardization. The clowns again chime in saying we're completely inadequate file security. Now, one thing to note is NFS is basically just for sharing files. And a little bit of logging protocol. It doesn't link to anything else. SMB has been overloaded things to carry all kinds of stuff, such as remote administration of NT and 95 boxes. Whereas CIFS, again, is a subset of SMB and not the same thing. SMB in general is claimed to be more secure than NFS. It has some authentication basics. We don't buy this. We go and analyze it and find it to be lacking. One of the arguments for that additional security is that it runs over TCP, which is really irrelevant because NFS can do that now too. It helps a little bit against things like UDP spoofing. For most values of it. So people out on the firewalls list and whatnot are still going to be fairly confused about what's still there and what lives on what corners and stuff. This is just sort of a clarification of the big ones. These services, there's two basic halves to the way SMB services work. There's the NetFire's main service on one side and the actual SMB transport on the other. Without the main service, an SMB can't really work. So it all has to be running, basically, to make a server work at all. So it's really a little harder. I was trying to illustrate the layering. There's a lot of protocol layering that goes on here. At the outermost layer, we have the backing from a wire or a PPP line or token RAN or what have you. Inside that, we have IP. Now, we're not going into any mention of other transport like IPX or similar things that run over the same media, because we're talking about remote attacks here that happen through a routed IP network. So inside IP, of course, there's UDP and TCP. UDP is generally chosen for a lot of this because it can be broadcasted easily. And NetFire is a fairly chatty protocol. It trades a lot of names back and forth. Machines tell each other that they're online by broadcasting to everybody. So on port 137, we have the main service. There's a connectionless SMB mode that runs on UDP 138 for things like browser announcements, PDP, finding the domain controller in a local environment. And interestingly enough, you can have a remote announce facility where one IP subnet can start an announcing set up into another IP subnet. Under TCP, port 135 of the RPC locator is just worth mentioning as a problem because recently people found if you connect to it with Telnet or something and bang in random characters that it crashes. Something should tell you that there's a problem here. The thing most defined is TCP 139 is the actual session transport. Inside that, over the TCP stream, gets past a four-bit integer link plus the actual SMB. So each transaction, be it a request or a response, is the four-bit integer link SMB, all the way down. This is so the TCP layer knows how much to read off the connection to parse out. Within the SMB protocol, we have the file sharing basics, which form CIFS, the authentication and session establishment stuff, and then here the NetBIOS session and SMB session are not the same thing. One encloses the other. Also, the center spooling and a whole bunch of remote procedure call-like things, usually called transactions, which handle a lot of this other stuff, like getting server information, passing user lists back and forth, probably primary to backup domain control, and the remote registry editing. The thing is, index batching is a way to go on several SMBs together into one and send them all over in one block. The original intent was to do things fast, like say, open up a file, read something out of it, close, and get out in one shot. Over the base faster network, you don't really need to do that, so keeping it separate makes it a lot easier for implementers. So if you want to attack one of these servers, what do we do? Well, back in February, a lot of you know, they released some papers from that and described it in fair detail. It's a good starting point for reading up on it. By now, some things in the paper are out of date. I got a few simple syntax problems wrong. Various things that release NT are not true now. They're true in the alphas or betas. Likewise with Samba. The newer versions of Samba have a lot more stuff in them. And if you've never got into some other things that had a possibility, such as, for instance, that remote announcing of foreign networks, poisoning main caches and whatnot. Much of the information for that came right out of the BitIFS specs, which Microsoft offers to the public. It's also made on the Samba site. So, an attack on a CIFS server is pretty straightforward. You all enter the front door, you rattle the knob, but it's surprisingly effective most of the time. One of the first steps in doing most of these things is to find what target net to play with, locate all the servers on it, with ping or any other IP connectivity test. You can skip a step by doing main queries by UDP, and if anything answers, you not only know it's there, but now you have some other information you need to attack it. The basic step, and I'm trying to compare NFS versus CIFS here, is to get some mailing information, use that to get lists of the resources it shares, such as files or printers, and then try to connect to those resources. NFS stops here. Once you're doing file I.O., that's all it does. Under CIFS, once you're connected up, you can do all these other things too. A good analogy here is walking into the casino and there's lots of security down there. The guards, all over the place. A lot of high dollars passed through there, so it's important. So it looked like a generic story between one run past, but other places around the hotel have considerably less security. And then the people in the casino don't know what happens past that. It's a direct formal attack, doesn't work. There are several tricks in those protocols that are fairly common knowledge now. Under NFS, we have some port map gain to get the port map to do stuff for you, and the server would be more likely to believe it. Old NFSs believe the host name you hand it in. There are UID or GID games you can play. You can basically be any UID you want. Except root. If you manage to compromise a server, you can then in turn compromise its clients by handing out security programs or loading servers into legitimate users trying to run stuff. Under SIS, we have the null session problem where the username or password is required to still get a few bits of information out of the machine. A SIP server believes whatever client name you handle in verbatim, it doesn't care. There's not much separation. If one user mounts a share, say, create a drive Z, then all users of that machine can see that and access it, possibly with the same credentials. And again, compromised servers and trojans can be inserted. Neither protocol does much logging. You have to turn it on. If you turn it on, it's still not much good under SIP because it never logs the IP address. It was never made aware of the IP address issue. It exists entirely within IP. And in general, the client's machines are given too much trust to supply information. It's a little easy to take a lot of that out. Some might ask at this point, what is a good file sharing protocol? And I haven't heard any good answers yet. The industry consensus seems to be there's not really a good one. Anybody seen Mudge yet?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Why don't you say something? So go to the phases a little more closely. The main determination can double as a remote network flows. If you take a tool like, say, NETCAT, which a lot of you have heard about, you can jam a fixed set of bytes through it to UDP-137. A name and static query is a fixed invariant thing. Nothing changes depending on what the host is going through. And you get all this trash back if it's listening on that. Here are the tools you can get a nice long list of this stuff. NTP status, equivalent standard, NMD lookup. The important thing to know here are these main types. These are hex. 20 and 3 are significant. 20 means sharing resources that are further in the file. 3 is generally for the messaging service, but also often indicates who's logged in on the console. You get a username from that that you can try on a later page. The various services running register these names with the main service, just like RPC services register with Fortinet. Another probing technique that's worth trying is directed IP broadcast, such as targetnet.255. You might get a storm of replies back at that point. Once you've got main list, you can connect up and try to access resources. You can determine a list of usernames from the type of threes or guesses or commonly known things like guest and administrator. The red button program that came out a while ago demonstrated that you can enumerate lists of users in an unpatched NMP box and get the whole user list anyway. And the null session hack is worth trying also just to see if you get through the thing and see if it's sharing resources at all. The magic IPC share needs to be there for a whole lot of other things to work, such as the share list, getting a share list. So you can try to connect directly to that, even if you don't know what any of the other service names are. From that, you can get lists of other service names. A slightly side note here, this is a packet fragment from one of the NetBIOS session setup things, where the names are passed back and forth in RFC 101 and 102 format. The elements of the name are split into, each character is split half and half into 4-bit chunks, and then added a capital A. So instead of space padded, which is 20 hex, that becomes CA. In these packet dumps, we always see CA, 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 and that's where the caca comes from. So we can get in using known stuff. We can try some brute force techniques. There's two kinds of authentication, and Mike is going to go over this in excruciating detail. There are various dialect levels which say, I'm a full-blown NT server, I can do fancier authentication protocol, or I'm a dumb old landman client, and I can't do that. I have to pass a plain text password or a lamer encryption scheme. The client can simply lie to the server and say, I'm a dumb landman box, I can't do this. So the server says, okay, we'll use the weakest deal with you. If NT has set up a lockout account after a certain number of tries, there's an interesting feature where if the first few attempts that would otherwise get in, if the password's wrong, it waits 2.5 seconds or so before saying no. Except that once lockout happens, the reply comes back instantly. So if you get, say, 5 authentication attempts that have a delay and all of a sudden it says no really fast, you know that account got locked out and is not worth trying again for 30 minutes or so. This is pretty dumb. They should have maintained the turnout. Since the logging is so lame, you could run this kind of brute force thing all night on, say, the administrator account, which does not get locked out. And they never know the difference unless they took a packet monitor to it. You can get around the delay pretty trivially by the delay is imposed per TCP connection. So if you open up 10 connections to the box, you've reduced your 2-second delay down to 0.2 seconds. And just feed a different chunk of the dictionary and let her rip. So chances are really good that you will get in. And once you're in, you can do all kinds of stuff, obviously. Modify things, pop registry entries in, launch backdoor services, load Trojans in, or just, you know, be destructive if that's your particular thing. So basically, the servers, the main servers of any given organization, could certainly fall victim to this, but people tend to give them a little more attention and maybe lock them down a little harder. If this is the case, the server may be harder to crack than the desktop client. The desktop clients often offer file sharing as well, and were set up by their individual users. And they're likely to be set up in pretty lame ways, but go after them. You have to pretty much view the entire network of these machines as a single entity if you're going to protect it, because the client desktops are only one hop away from the server, and if they're compromised, the server follows sort of shortly thereafter. To illustrate the transmissivity issue, and a lot of us are familiar with it from SNCCR attacks, you get a few passwords, people going outbound to other sites, and then there's other sites that are falling right and left. The same thing applies to this file sharing. It's even more interesting because if somebody dials into the work, does the work for a while, has the file sharing turned on, say, to trade stuff back and forth, then logs out of work and goes to surf the web, forgot to turn off the file sharing and lock his box down first. ISP dial-ins are being routinely scanned for vulnerable machines, as well as in cable modems or a broadcast kind of protocol, and other people's machines start popping up all over the place if you turn on the network neighborhood browsing. So this box with the corporate jewels on it, you know, copies thereof, could be compromised from outside without the user even knowing while he's surfing the web, and off it goes. And if there's any kind of authentication information in there, the user's corporate network could fall before he even logs out of his web surfing account. Trade shows and conferences, such as, you know, the room across the hall is another place to be wary. So be paranoid about this stuff. Transmissivity is just mushrooms in an incredibly rapid way. So what tools do we have available to attack CIFS? Well, a year ago there weren't too many of them, except the standard clients to come with machines. All of them are valid. Now there's a whole bunch of new stuff. You know, Netcat plus scripts again for simple probing. NetUse that comes with the Microsoft platforms is good enough, as is the original SMB client. Just connect up, try to authenticate things. The CIFS paper had a sort of lame patch which turned it into a brute forcer. You know, it was small but effective, because brute force is a valid attack. Secure Networks released a tool based on the SMB client called NAT10, NetBIOS Assessment Tool or something like that. It's available there. It's interesting to note that when they rebuilt SMB client, there's an unused main in client.c, which is not really the original SMB client main. They've got some other stuff thrown in, and it's worth looking at. It's the precursor to another phase of an attack tool where you can change a bunch of parameters in the SMB session once you're up and running, such as UIDs and PIDs and whatever else you think you can fake out. Even simple Perl scripts can attack this stuff just by, because they have the network primitives inside. There's a red button thing which exploited the null session to get information out of the machine. It's available here. I'm not sure what the path is, and I'm not sure what that company called itself this week. Check it out. Once you have this authenticated session, you can do anything you want to it. You can, once you get the password or the authentication stuff, just use the regular registry editor or end user manager. I think that's the user manager for domains on NT to do remote stuff on the box. Samba can do the null session thing just for checking, but there's no real registry editing or admin stuff built into it. And if anybody knows the difference, I'd love to hear about it. It would be really nice to have a Unix-5 way to administrate NT boxes. So just to note, if full front attacks don't work, there are other problems that often crop up. Local wire stuff, you can take over TCP connections, because once the stuff is authenticated up, everything runs in the clear, it's subject to all the TCP attacks that we know about. Servers, again, compromised servers. One interesting thing is if you have a relay box that's pretending to be a server, it can relay and turn over to the real server and then become man in the middle. And again, naming attacks are an interesting avenue that needs to be explored further. It's probably a lot easier than DNS because this stuff is designed to believe what it hears on the wire and not question it. We should also mention the Internet Explorer bugs, one through whatever they're up to these days, there's a pile of them. The only ones involve forwarding file URLs that would point to SMB servers by IP address, and that server could lay a trap for the authentication information as it came in. ActiveX in Java, we won't go there. Another interesting thing that happens often on the web, if the web server looks like it wants some kind of authentication, IE will often just send it to the web server. And, well, my web server doesn't ask for this stuff, so completely unbidden, a couple of boxes handed in this basic before encoded mess, which turns out to be somebody's authentication information. Why it sent me this, I have no clue, but of course I could have collected this in dictionary fashion. Crypto time. So it's crypto time. We're going to drill into this pretty hard, and a lot of people's eyes will possibly glaze over at this point. It gets pretty complex, but that's okay. It enters the picture at two fundamental points. First one being storage of user passwords in a safe way that doesn't reveal the plain text. It's usually done by hashing. There are two kinds of hashing used in SIS, which we'll go into. The other place where crypto comes in is authenticating a session machine to machine. There are two kinds that can happen under the wire, plain text, and again, a lot of servers, if they can't do the stronger authentication, they have to back up and retry whatever was sent in as a plain text password and accept it. That's apparently part of the spec, go figure.
Yeah,
you know
the crypto shit.
And then
you pull in this one, like,
get
through mine, you come back.
Yeah, why don't you start, and then you want to start with pictures.
Okay,
cool. But anyway, I'm going to turn this over to Mutch, because he's actually got a much broader view of the crypto stuff. And we will both kind of chime in here with pretty pictures and different approaches to looking at it. And hopefully, between the two, we'll get the information out there. All right, how did someone talk? We kind of figured we're similar enough, and Jeff has said, well, why don't you guys tag team my job tomorrow? So, oh, there you go. And so you two quasis separate. Yeah, we're modest, okay. Two quasis separate talks here that we're going to key back in together, and we're going to kind of show it off and on. Hobbit has a much better representation, I think, visually, and probably a little better understanding of how the cryptographic really works. We just have to implement some of it. So I'm going to go over the eye-glazing parts of things, and hopefully Hobbit will be able to wake everybody back up. All right, Microsoft stores the user's password. They store them inside the same registry. And they store the two passwords, as Hobbit has mentioned. They store the LAN one-way function, and they store the NC dialect one-way function. The reason that they had two of them is going to become, we don't know exactly why, but this point is number of witness to how it's going to be. Okay. Jeremy Allison, the guy who's working on the Samba tool, came out with the program PWDump, which is a fantastic program which deobfuscates how the passwords, or the hashes, I should say, are stored inside the registry. So when you run it, it goes in and says, okay, we know that little lane way we're trying to kind of hide how this is being done. And pulls back out something that looks quasi-like, and that's your password entry. So you have the username, you set the equivalent of the UID, and imagine here would be normally where the actual salt and password for Unix certain thing is, if you want running shadows, followed by another one of those. Okay. So the first one ends up being the LAN hash, and the second one ends up being the NC hash. So when we say, well, geez, how are the passwords derived? LAN is an old protocol that came out of IBM, I believe. Is that correct? Was that the only original one?
Yes.
Microsoft 1.3 OS 2? Okay. Oh, excellent. So Microsoft is responsible for this piece of shit. Beautiful. Okay. Passwords can be no longer than 13 characters in length. Well, that's not bad, because your Unix password can really only be 8 characters in length in most cases. It's concatenated after that. I'm sorry if it's truncated. If the password is greater than 14 characters, we usually think of N3 plus the standard, negative, it conjugates it. If it's less than 14 characters, it's hashed out with null. So you're always going to have a 14 byte value sitting there. That's really interesting. We're going to see why they do that. Oh, do we also say that the password has to be all uppercase? You can put it in a lowercase password, but it turns its uppercase when it's stored in there. So, 14 characters uppercase, well, maybe you can argue it might be a little better, or equal to 8 characters mixed case. But what they end up doing is they take this 14 byte string and they split it into two halves. They add they derive by the sort of key function, which you can see in the Samba tool, an odd parity 8 byte des key from each 7 byte half. So they have these two odd parity 8 byte des keys. Should we show the sprinkle? You want to show the sprinkle slide right now? Okay. Hobbit's going to show you right now how they do these sprinkle slides, and I'm going to tell you why splitting it in half was probably the stupidest thing they potentially ever could have done. So the word derive up there before implies a whole lot. And here's part of the derivation, but also it also occurs all over the place in the other elements of how the crypto works. If any of you looked at Sturda key inside the Samba code, I have skipped a step here. It's moved down, it's the way to derive 8 bytes of dead key from 7 bytes of input. And what happens first, the things will move down a slightly different way, and then all the bytes of the death key are left shifted. It doesn't matter. This is the net effect. Now, when a user types in a password, it's generally 7-bit ASCII with the high bit clear. So the high bits of each password byte are going to be clear. That is the those dark ones up there. This pops known 0 bits into the dev key. And not only has them showing up in known places, but reduces the key space, the absolute key space there, to about 49 bits. Subsequent limitations in the character set take it down to maybe 41 or so. Well, you know, we all know what 40-bit encryption keys are like. I've represented this set as a little icon. I call this the sprinkle icon. For lack of a better term, I don't know what they call it. The Microsoft people in their spec call it a swab and claim that they're reversing the bits over the entire chunk of space. It's not the case. Somebody got wrong information when they wrote the spec. At any rate, this icon shows up everywhere, and we'll see it a lot.
Cool. I'm going to go back into why that's the 7 characters.
All right, we're going to pull more of our slides in just a couple more seconds here. Let me figure out why I did with my phone.
Great.
Yep, tag. Okay, so we saw that that's how we're driving the 8-byte odd parity dev key. And we can already start to see that Microsoft really is doing the best critical job here. So remember, we have these 2 7-byte values that are used to drive the 8-byte odd parity dev key by that sprinkle function that you saw. We then take a known constant. It's written down on one of the slides. Microsoft gets upset every time you mention it because they say giving this out helps mitigate and ruin the security behind all of that stuff. It doesn't, but there wasn't any security to begin with. And if they take the 2-byte result and they encrypt it, they encrypt the first 8-byte result against the known string. They take the second 8-byte value and encrypt it against the known string. And then they just concatenate it. There's no feedback here, there's no looping. You can see exactly why this is insane. I'll show you real quickly what's actually happening here, so I'm just describing it. So we have user 2A, who is not just a clever username, his password actually happens to be 2A. 2A becomes capital AA. AA happens to be less than 14 characters in length, so it's padded out with all nulls, so you have 12 nulls following it. And they break it apart into these two strings. There is the first 7-byte one, and there's the second 7-byte one. That's a good string right there. But I'm putting things with. Excellent. For each one of those, is used when they say 30 keys, string 1, which was AA, and 5 nulls, and 30 keys, string 2, which was 7 nulls. And each one of those is then derived, they set up the address key schedule, and if you have questions about that, you can look inside, like Eric Young's SSLEAY kit, probably live there, but this is just standard DESI-CB. The known constant is then encrypted against the first one, so we now have this output string here. The known constant is encrypted against the key schedule that was derived from the all nulls, and we have the second part up there. Okay. We follow this point. This is going to get really neat. Just a second. They can translate them together. That was that passage that you saw at the very beginning. So, well, we know we can work back, well, we can do the same thing for like a case note attack at this point. But let's see exactly why that landman hash happens to be so lame. Well, there's no fault. In Unix, you have a salt in front of the password. So if I have the password as secret, and I set up a user secret, and I do password on another machine, and my password is secret, there's 256 possible combinations that derive from time of the salt that can be used to encrypt it. So when you look in the password file and you see that encrypted string, it's not the same on both of the systems. They don't have this here. If user 2A has 2A, and then user, you know, Fubar has a password 2A, those things look identical in that hash.
That's not too good.
On top of that, check this out. All you have to do is go, just make a pointer here. All you have to do is go looking through for the AAD3B435 part. We know that that's worth 7 characters or less. So now we no longer have a 14 character long thing we have to worry about. We have a 7 character long password that's always converted to capital. I think my Unix pass is starting to win a little bit here. Alright, we just mentioned that part down there with the AAD3B4 write.
Let's see, what's the next part that you have over in yours? Because I don't want to.
You have one
that graphically shows what we just did right there?
Yeah.
Okay, let me talk about how the NT version is done real quick, because you've got it all on one slide.
Yep.
Okay, well, we said that they have two hashes stored next to each other. So Microsoft, in their infinite wisdom, said, hey, okay, Landman's a little bit lame, we might admit that, so we're going to have an NT password hash stored. And the NT password hash we're going to try and do a little bit better. The NT password can be up to 128 characters in length. That's not bad. It's case sensitive. That's getting better. The password's converted to Unicode, doesn't really matter. But we're looking down here. For those of you who don't know what Unicode is, it's a different way of representing characters, such as if I had the letters capital A, capital A, 0x41, 0x41, it's been represented as 0x41, 0x00, 0x41, 0x00. So they have an extra null afterwards. And this is to put things such as like kanji characters set up in that can't be represented in a type with an information there. Password is then run through RSA's message digest 4. Pretty decent message digest. And people will argue, oh, well, 5 a little bit more secure, or 4, you know, a little bit less. They're pretty good. And they get a really opening 16-byte value, and that's the NT hash. That's the second part that you saw. And so I think I'm going to let Hobbit show this in a graphical fashion, because he happens to have a real nice some graphics right here. Explain the oh, okay. Hobbit's getting shy. So here we see basically both of them have it on the Landman hash on the left, the NT hash on the right. 14 characters, 1,000, breaking into 7. So you see the typical thing that Hobbit describes. The throwing away bit there. What we start talking about a little bit with Lostec doesn't take advantage of this, but takes advantage of the overlying Landman. And then, oh, here it is. Everybody write this down. 0-4-D, 4-7, 5-3, 2-1, 4-0, 2-3, 2-4, 2-5. Everybody should email Microsoft security at Microsoft.com and put that in the subject line. So, and here they basically concatenate the two 8-byte responses that they get with the Landman one-way function that you saw in the right entry dump. Over here with the DMC one, you've got the 128, which actually ends up being 256 length that they're throwing into because of the Unicode, the NAD 4-routine, and actually, well, up to, I should say, and they derive the DMC one-way function that way.
Again. One interesting thing to note here, these output hashes for these things are equivalent to passwords. They can be used directly for later phases of authentication. And if you can steal those, you have to pay keys to pay them just as though you had the user's password. They're just harder to remember because they're long hex strings.
SAM storage?
Yeah, one of them.
SAM storage.
All right, let's change track to a bit here. Recently, a thing called PDW Dump came out, Jeremy Allison and crew. Well, I'll tell you, it was a happy day at Avian Research when this one was popped publicly, because for a long time it remained unknown. Turns out that Microsoft realized that since those hashes were the keys to the kingdom, storing them directly in the SAM, even though it's, you know, protected, quote-unquote, is a bad idea.
So they decided to re-encrypt them under a sort of obfuscation scheme. Turned out that the user's relative ID,
who's the pimp,
is used as a very simple permutation to encrypt each half of the one-way function. The relative ID is sort of bit sprinkled down to create another 7-byte thing, sprinkled again, and that's used as a dead end key to encrypt the one-way function into how it's actually stored in the SAM. Note, this is a bidirectional function. I didn't actually show this way. So, because it has to be decrypted again for comparison against the original one-way during authentication. So, how does this authentication work? Well, let's get into that.
Yes. Oh, keep that for a little bit.
It was a very happy day for the people over at Law. We decided to come out with a little tracking tool. We said, well, NPE needs to track also. So we wrote this up, and we said, you know, this is great. Now people can go through it. But we carry it back. It's only one round dead. Since there is no fault, this is going to fly. This is going to go very quickly. We told people, we said, that's going to be. We tried to get it some media attention to try and like stop the Microsoft giant. Nobody cared. You know what we did? We put a GUI around it. Media buys hooked right up. And at the same time, we could say, well, geez, now not only can the quote-unquote script kiddies run it, but the administrators will be able to also. Uh-oh, I'm in trouble now. Okay, so, simply, you see how it's done, and we're going to walk you through how we attack it. We said, the important thing you have to be able to do, or you have to be able to simply compare, that's the standard dictionary stuff. There's two things in there. There's land man, and there's the NP one. So we say, well, we'll take the land man hand, or we'll take the NP hand. You can specify on the command line or whatever. Or, if you don't say anything, we'll simply compare trying the land man and derive the NP hash because of it. Remember how strong and how nice that NP hash was in security comparison to the land man function? Well, guess what? We're storing the same piece of plain text right next to each other. One stores in a secure way, one stores in a much less secure way. What's the total level of security at this point? It's the lowest common denominator. If you can break the land man one, you know what the NP is going to be. Okay, it happens to be capital N lowercase a, that doesn't matter. If you get the land man one, you'll know it's AA. If you just run through the second at that point, four possible combinations, and you're going to have that the NMD version. And I don't know how long it takes for the most computers to run through four permutations. It doesn't take mine too long. So now we want the dictionary attack. Look at the layman only. Take a dictionary word. What if we do the same function to get the hash coming out? We can throw away words if we see that they're longer than 7 characters, so we can just look through the universe and say, see, 7 characters less, 8 characters or more. The nice thing is, since there's no fault, for each word we only encrypt it once, and run through the entire list of users. Because if user A has a password of secret and user F has a password of secret, they're both going to be stored identically. Why bother to spend the extra CPU cycle with any encrypting password? Each one you do one stream going through. I think the times that were focused back on this were 120 megabits stadium, 8 meg dictionary file, 3,000 users, 47 seconds. I might be off, it might have been a minute, but... Okay, we can look at the MD4 file, or the NFC MD4 file also. We do the same thing, what we end up doing is we say, you might not have all possible things, uppercase and lowercase permutations for a word in the dictionary like dog, which would be 2 to the 3rd. So we just want to do that ourselves, and we have a little, originally recursive function was really showing dependence of the cache. And then we can iteratively, and you will from when the log then helps us write a lot of those. So questions on that can go to him. So we just put it in the exact same way. As we said before, why bother going after the NQ1 only when you can rely on the weaker one here and just run through to the string length of possible permutations to derive the state sensibility. The thing that we're really impressed with, we've been known to do a few freaking dictionary of bad things. If you remember, Monkey came out to break the SP challenge responses we saw go by, or some of the covers thing with the buffer underflow, because we're overflow the cafe now. We said, geez, you can brute force this. You can be guaranteed to return all the passwords. I don't think there's ever been another public operating system, at least not widely spread, such as Unix or NT, that not only could you dictionary attack it, but you could go through the entire possible key space and be guaranteed to get the passwords back. Because Microsoft was hiding behind saying, well, don't choose passwords that show up in the dictionary. Don't choose cat. Don't choose dog. And now we're saying, don't choose anything 14 characters or less. So we'll get it. Now, we're going to see that they actually split them in the channel we're trying to play. Here's the thing that actually, if you are in charge of an NC network or you have to manage it and you're in charge of some sort of security, first off, I'm sorry, but second off, the strongest password length in NC is 7 characters. You saw why that was, they break it at the 7-byte boundary. If it happens to be 10 characters, you'll get to the 3 on the other side when you're in the 3rd round. And you just match it up when you're going into the 7th round, you're going to pass it by anyway. You know, you will have a 7. So 10 is no stronger than 7. So if you're going to enforce the password length policy, my recommendation is 7. If somebody hits it with like a 70 or 75 megahertz, they will only take them just about a month. And if somebody hits it with compiled and local spark, it's probably going to take them about a day and a half for a long-term secret to be broken. So I'll quickly show you how we're going to do it for us. Well, this is obviously an example. Credit to Microsoft for wanting that lane. Even 7A ends up having a password of 7A with various case permutations on it. User 10A ends up having this other password. So we look inside the registry and we say, here's what the hash has come out to be. And the first thing we can notice is that we see a lazy 3C4 3 button. That person's got 7 characters or less, we know that. This person we know has 8 characters or more because the second half doesn't match up to that. Break them apart. Set up the flag. And so I'm going to use this right up here saying, hey, this guy's 7 characters or less or 7 characters or more, yada yada. Okay, you're running through the dictionary, so you're starting with the A, then you're going to go to AA, and then you're going to go to AA. Well, for the first time, we're trying to single A, we even have to bother comparing it to the first half of the person with 10A. We know we don't because we saw that the unit password was greater than that, so we're only going to do it compared to the second half, which means we only have to do half the number of encryptions that Microsoft did in the first place to generate the thing. We go up and we say it doesn't match. We try it against the first half, which is a 7A, and don't bother trying it against the second half because we already know what that is. And then we move on up. We see on 10A on the 3rd one that it matched, so we plug it in on the right-hand side. We keep going up until we hit 7 iterations of A, and we've actually gotten the user 10 and the user 7 at the same time.
Of course, that just gives you back the landman password, which is all A's, so you simply run through 2 with 7 or 128 possible combinations to give the MVP one back, and 2 with 10 is 1,024. If anybody, even if you're not really into crypto or not, you know, really, really decent, you know, mathematician, which I'm really neither of those, 1024 is not a big number. So what could you use Lostag for? Well, Lostag Gold now, because we're going to be doing that something else for you guys as a special test contribution. So these new critics can obviously audit users much more effectively by using the available Microsoft tool. The Microsoft tool that I've seen will pretty much, we will put in a dictionary and it will actually attempt to log you on as such. So if you have to run that, you have to turn off any sort of user lockouts that you have after X number of passwords, and you start locking out all the users. And there's no way Microsoft can be able to convince all the minions who are running their software to say, if you want to run a security audit or check your user's password, please disconnect from the network because you're going to have to turn off the ability to lock out and yada, yada, yada. People rely upon Microsoft to sit there and say, geez, Microsoft always comes up with some solution. We're secure because we're secure. We're secure because we're using, quote, strong crypto, end quote. Well, they are. Dev is strong. I mean, yes, sure, we have those challenges, people are breaking the stuff. There are serious efforts. This is not a serious effort. This is like a 38633 type thing. But even MD4. MD4 is a strong, crypto also. If somebody says they're a strong crypto and that's why you should trust them, it's the implementation that makes the difference. Microsoft botched the implementation. Oh, of course, the most important one. What can you report? Well, if you're in attack and you actually happen to get onto a PDC, one of those one-way domain controllers, you get every user's password, it happens to give us 15 characters in length. Because we notice that if you have more than 14 characters, you can still get the landman side of it, but you wouldn't necessarily get the NT side. It doesn't matter, you can still say, as Robin pointed out, hello, Mr. NT server, I'm a dumb old landman flyer. And it'll let you in with that one. We could add on a couple to get up to a 16 without being tremendously expensive. Apparently, Microsoft corporate board in Redmond all run off one primary domain controller. We would love to see a registry get on with this. Because we'd be able to, in 1.5 days, maybe 2 days, and that all 3,000, 5,000 employees on that was probably 30,000 or 40,000 really. Employees, 22,000? A little birdie just put 22,000 on the PDC over there for corporate. Including Billy Boy. Somebody should drop that one to a new list. So Microsoft had a response for this. They didn't care about it before, but we had to Google on it, so they had to respond. And the response was, don't you need to get the passwords like chatters off. They're not getting this. Sorry. They came out with a SysKey patch to prevent the administrator from reading the hash values out of the registry. So they said, well, if we can hide it from our administrators, then the problem goes away. This is called the office syndrome. So, of course, I showed this slide to some Microsoft people, and they just love the fact that I used the phrase, Microsoft made it so that only the attackers could use the tool by emasculating the administrator. Everybody kind of winced a little bit. So now the administrator couldn't run the tool on his own to ensure that his password specifications were being adhered to and that users weren't really being stupid. I shouldn't say stupid. As creative as users can be sometimes. They didn't learn out anything. So our response to that, so here's 1.5. Does everything that 1.0 does. We fixed the problem of overflowing the sending of two gets because we ran all this stuff on usually non-PC-ish type boxes. And luckily, somebody actually pointed out that we had a tremendous performance problem with the size of our function.
But now we say, okay, sit on the network. Microsoft does this challenge response stuff because they know that if you can even get the one-way hash by itself, you couldn't send it across the network. So they send out a challenge, get a response, and they say, okay, in this way, nobody actually sees that hash go by. We said, yeah, but you didn't do it right. So now I'm going to have to show you from around, 20,000 foot thing, how they're doing the network stuff, and then I'm going to talk about our side of it.
Where? So, Carastar. Hey, you're assuming the cares are 54?
No. I'm fine. Okay. When a SIP client could also authenticate against the SIP server in the newer protocols, there's a challenge response scheme. The magic one-way hash between the kingdom is used in this as the authentication cookie, in effect. What they do here, the one-way hash is 16 bytes. They add and tack on 5 known nulls, bringing a total of bytes to 22. That's 7 times 3, and each is picked apart in chunks of 7, runs through that sprinkling thing again. When the connection is established, the server issues a random 8-byte challenge for certain values of random, that is. The sprinkled elements from the one-way hash plus the nulls are used to encrypt the challenge 3 separate times. Those results are concatenated together, again with no kind of chaining, and sent back a total of 24 bytes to the server. And it does the same thing on the other side and compares what it expects as a response. The big problem with this is that, again, no chaining. The one-way hash is the secure storage of the user's password. Since the tail end of it is all null, we know this, it's in spec, there are 2 bytes left that might be random. And this whole section is isolated. So we take the 5 nulls and run through 64K possible combinations over those 2 bytes, run through sprinkle and encrypt the challenge, and compare against the third chunk of the response. Now, working backwards against, along the landing or the root and NFT side responses, we can start to determine this. We observe the challenge and the response on the wire, so we derive this information in the first place. Anyway, once you're authenticated, it's a regular TCP session, again, over all the known attacks. We'll go over the signing here.
Oh, cool.
This is kind of an aside. So, to present against this, Microsoft is designing this message signing spec. It's a little similar to the, Novell message signing stuff.
Yeah, but that must be 3 now, right?
Yes, this comes with Service Pack 3 for NT. You have to turn it on, of course, but it's there if you want it. Unfortunately, it prevents Windows 95 and older boxes from working against NT in this mode because the other ones can't do it. It's only NT to NT which comes into play. There's a field in the SMB header which is normally all zeroed out and unused, so they decided to put a message signature into that. So here we have, just after the authentication phase that we saw a minute ago, we have the user's one-way hash, the long-term secret. We have the encrypted 24-byte response we just sent across the wire. That whole thing is taken as the signing secret for a keyed hash function. So it's that number of bytes is just held at one end of this long string, along with a 4-byte sequence number, which always starts at 1. Note that the encrypted response is known because we saw it on the wire. We know the sequence if we observe the session setup that it starts at 1. Therefore, the whole sequence of this reduces once again to 1-way hash. This is all plugged into this entire string here, and the slide is not really clear. This entire string is run through MD5, node 5 now, not 4. They're stepping up in the world here. That generates a 16-byte hash, the first 8 of which are taken off
pop back into the SMB header, and this the SMB header plus message is sent across the other end. This happens, you know, in both directions of the communication, timing and then checking on the other end. But this is, you know, the thing we're using as a session key and even calling a session key in the crypto universe is not a session key. So this protocol can also be attacked. Jumping back to the authentication now, that was just an aside about the message signing. We're over to that now. The original authentication setup can be attacked. Here's an overview of the whole sequence with all the sprinkling steps and encryption orchestrated. Small clarification, winners last minute. This piece here is the user's one-way hash. We can take our dictionary, run it through, sprinkle and encrypt with a known constant. We can pre-compute all this offline and store it in a file that will be slightly larger than the dictionary we started with. Now the five nulls attack font is used to encrypt the challenge. And again, 64K combinations on the last 2 bytes plus null. If the second part of the LANMAN one-way hash is representing all null storage, as it is with a short password, this is a known string now. And if we take that known string, take the last byte of this element, run through all possibilities on that, which is 256, compare this piece of the response, we know how long the password was. So now we have these two sections of the response mashed. We also know the last byte of the first chunk of the one-way hash. So in our pre-computed dictionary, we can throw out all the entries that don't have that as the last byte. And this will cut down the search space significantly on brute forcing the first chunk. So the whole thing, when we work backwards, is really subject to analysis.
You want to keep going?
Yeah, I
want to
go back on this.
What's your next
summary.
Okay, yeah. All right, so Hava came over to my place one day, and he said, come on, check this out. This is amazing. This is
amazing.
That was
sick.
That
the major crypto gods are going
to. Oh, yeah. Hava and I recently gave a little talk a couple days ago, and we were really thrilled. A gentleman by the name of Bruce Schneier was out there. He's here for DEF CON also, throughout implied cryptography. And we were going through how Microsoft, how other people had found it, and how what we were doing to break it, because we thought it was so lame. And every time we say, you know, we start getting on a slide, we get like, no, they're not really doing that. And the Microsoft guy sitting right behind him going, uh-oh. Little hair on the back of his neck that went up and everything. It was amazing. So, let me digress briefly. LogSec 1.0 was written the day that the CWW came out. It didn't get released for a little while for some other reasons. But I had the flu, and so whenever I had the flu, I'd be here at work, and she was up 3 o'clock in the morning, because I can't sleep, I might as well be miserable, I might as well stay at work. And so I wrote LogSec. About 3 months later, came down the road, and about 3 months later, down the road, we were looking at this 50 patch just come out. This was actually a couple weeks ago, maybe. And I was thinking again. I said, well, what are we going to think? I worked on the wrong track. We wrote the 1.5 version from talking to Hobbit. So my words of wisdom to Microsoft is they want this type of chip to stop. They need to keep me healthy. Okay, Hobbit came over basically in Hobbit-ese, ranting and raving and spewing foam and everything, going, look, crikey, this is amazing. What are these guys smoking over there? Explain to me what you just explained in the slider. So here's what we did with it. And then, all right, we can buy this ever. That's not even bad. We can sit on our network. We can watch this stuff go back and forth. So the client requests a log on challenge, as you saw. So it sends back the 8-byte challenge. Client does encrypt it, blah, 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 sends it back and starts the 24 bytes in it. The first thing that
down what the mill cracked us up. He said, add 5 mills, bring it to a length of 21. So, can we look at this 7? Do these three steps look really familiar? Isn't that pretty much what the landman function did in order to get it? How old is the landman stuff? Mike himself knew that he could come out with EMP, or dielectric that was using MD4 to improve it. They said, okay, we're going to move in the correct direction that way. We're starting to deal with the network stuff. We've got the EMP machine talking back and forth. We're right up to the sound response, so let's do it the stupid way again. And sure, how they did. Okay. Let's skip on there. And to show you exactly like an example of how it moves along. And this is exactly what you would be seeing. These are three, another clever name, if that would happen to be 3A or reverse. Landman hash, and we do 8 byte challenge going over the wire. Well, we know what the client's doing. The client's adding these 5 nodes to up to 21 bytes of length. Break it down a little briefly. Does the same spread length to get the 8 byte offset reserve key from the 7 byte string? Standard reserve key, standard dev set key to set up the key schedule. And now it's going to take all the responses out of there. So you can see it's the code, because we give up the code to everything we do or we try to. Which we do for Microsoft and do the same thing. And if you've gotten it, so you've got 1, 2, 3. That's going to be the first thing up to 16, up to 24 right there. You're going to see, I know I'm just going over what Bob just said a bit here, but we've got a real kicker at the very end. So you say, you get a dictionary with that, we'll do the same thing. We'll look at your hand in the dictionary and go through. It's trivial enough also to figure out if you use a password or 7 characters or less again. So we know we're only breaking it down to 7 to the potential key space length that we're attaching. Oh, by the way, the key space length for a landman ends up being about 40. So 7 to 40. Because you can only have, Microsoft specification says you can only have 8 through Z, 0 through 9, and a couple of punctuation characters. They actually say that certain other characters are simply not allowed, but they work just fine. We found out. So you can just plug it in, and we use the ones they're telling you not to use, and increase your security. If you want to start putting in meta characters, you know, alt 235 or something, you know, that will work. And they also said we can still report this because we can get it down to the 7 to the 40. So you notice that if we put, remember the AD3D4, yada, 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 which says that we're going to actually have a 7 character or less password. The way they ended up doing the groupings off of it, as you saw on another slide, we only have to run through 256 combinations there, and if it matches based upon the challenge that we saw, we have a pretty good belief that it was a 7 character or less password. We go through 64K iterations beyond that to guarantee it or to deny that. And if we guarantee it, which we probably will, we've also put it as breaking the first 7 characters at the same time. This is called economy of motion. There we are, pretty much the regular search, so I'm getting ahead of myself. I'll get them to look at the 7 in case they can understand it. To work backwards, to force the landman by basically going to the journal itself, case sensitive numbers, shall we say. And if there's a number missing. Okay, well, so the network, and you have MC machine talking to MC machine, and you have switch feedback installed, and you've got some sucker out there with a laptop running the landman. Or you've got somebody who's actually popped one of the Unix machines that happens to be on the same wire which we know that never happens inside the network, and they never set up snippers when they do that. And they grab all this. So Microsoft could have very easily said, I'm NT and I'm going from NT to NT, back and forth using LAN. And you know what? They did. They said you can do that in Service Pack 3. So I can say, I only want to authenticate using the NT dialect. Do not allow me to authenticate with the LAN one. That's good. That's a step in the right direction, because at that point, you know, we're going to have a hell of a lot more. We can't brute force it. We're going to have to be relegated down to a dictionary attack. And just about everything has to be dictionary attackable at some point. Well, it still sends both the LAN and NT hash along anyway. They just don't do anything with that one. So I guess our response after this is thank you. Okay, I'm going to hit my summary here, and then I guess I'll just get his summary. The same thing there. How many people had actually picked up WildDrive 1.0 and like had started digging around with it a little bit? Okay. You knew that the GUI wasn't, you know, up to snuff as far as the command line version was, and now you know why, because it was basically a marketing tool. I think the GUI is up to snuff with it. Guess what we're releasing today, as soon as I get off of talking here and get over to the laptop and the network? We're putting an offset 1.5 up for everybody with the full force. And of course, for the GUI now also. If any of you have the 1.0, you notice that we were saying, you kind of have to get into the limitations for the way we use it in the 2.0, because we plan on letting you do this without the administrator, because the registry stuff. And we came up with 1.5 here, which I'll be the first one of them. That's lame. We put on a 2.0 and we come out with 1.5. Well, I wasn't sick enough times to get the 2.0 out. So we're going to make it up for you when we come out with 2.0 should have a whole bunch of PDCs and BDCs on board. Do you want to be in a PDC now? We can do it. We want to, I'm trying to work together the sniffer kit to grab and other stuff for the challenge response. Right now, you might just have to talk to somebody like Router, modify one of the sniffer kits out there. We'll take it in the blog. It will go out for the 1.5. We want to also have a Windows-based one, so if you happen to be sitting on a Windows box, we can approach Microsoft and say, please give us a copy of your DVD page, because we know you have a package driver in there. And if it were DVD, it would work with them. And they said, yeah, so we'll see what happens. What's about a backup button? These are two. How many people are system engineers or network engineers in here? How many of you that have hands up and keep them up there for 3 seconds have NT boxes all of a sudden on your network, which you didn't have like 2 years ago?
You think how fucking shabby those things are? This is amazing! These things will not shut up! You know how they're doing, you know, the name derivation? On the terms of who the names are, if a machine comes up and says, I want to be name A, but name B, you know, right?
Yeah.
They see who can scream the loudest.
I'm machine A. Hello, this is Bob. I'm machine A.
Anybody? Come on.
This is ridiculous. So they have all this, and the Win stuff is the same way. Win stuff has a lot of fun, folks.
The ACP is just a new stuff. We've been looking into it. We're going to try and bundle it all up into what we call the Lost Disk Service Pack 1.
I'm going to thank you very much for your time. Wish you very well. And so, I'm just going to finish up here, Chris, and we will field questions I'm doing afterwards, okay? Thank you.
All right, let's summarize some of these crypto problems in general. No blockchaining, we mentioned. There's no need faulting from user passwords or date time, whatever else. There's the encrypted authentication stuff. It would have been really nice if a client could introduce some random material to commute the whole thing. In the message signing stuff, an early draft of it actually had hits at a client challenge piece, where the server would give its challenge, the client would generate some random material and use that as part of its return, which, you know, from which you could derive a session key and make it much less likely to attack. They took it out in the final release. They were denying it. They would be dangling it in front of our eyes and we went, oh, we can't have that, sorry. The user interface is limited to password length to 14 characters. Now, no, this is not in the login box where you're actually typing in your password. It's other places. The login box allows really long strings and it scrolls off the left or whatever. The limitation comes in like in user manager where you try to create a new user. You type out the 14 characters and then it starts to beep at you. In the command line net command, you can say net user and give a whole bunch of parameters and restrictions. If you give it a password of greater than 14 characters, it's an invalid password and won't take it. So if anybody's got a password longer than 14 characters, they went to extreme contortions to generate it, and they can probably only use it over the net anyway.
Remember 14 equals 7.
Yep. The session key was referred to in the specs. Once again, we use the AWS NT thing for hashes. And since the shared secret is involved here, it would have been pretty trivial to encrypt the whole SMB transport layer, deriving a real session key therefrom. There's no mechanism for this. One of Microsoft's arguments here is, gee, what if I change the whole spec and everything would be incompatible? But I think it's familiar with when the NT dialect was designed, it is incompatible. It's got a lot more fields in its responses. The whole thing is struct. If you look at the Stampa code, there's more fields. So they could have just made a new dialect designed correctly and then worked with backwards compatibility and just for the SMB field itself. Anyway, a few fixes for these problems are offered immediately by Microsoft. They have said you should pack a filter. Well, granted, you want to do it on NT, it's not really that much fun. The filtering is very non-versatile. From what I hear, if you lock out a certain port, you lock it out across the board, nobody can get there. That's great. Now you can't share files either. In Service Pack 3, there's the anonymous session or null session limitation. It can turn on. It still allows you to connect up as an anonymous user. It still accepts the authentication state and allows you to connect to ICP and start looking around. It just restricts some of the functionality inside that API interface. So nonetheless, you can still connect to ICP. And one of the things I think it would be useful to investigate is sending random data into that. That's one of the next things to do. Service Pack 3 clients and servers can enforce some of this stuff, but the server can finally enforce stronger encryption and all. They're refusing the dumb landing client. But of course, you have to turn that on too. Most people don't. They offer encryption over point-to-point tunneling protocol. I understood that it only worked over dialogue. Somebody said it also works over the net now. It tunnels through some high TCP port, which I believe is 5678. A nice high one that's usually left open in firewalls. Again, open to attack using the one-way hashes. So add that to your scam list. The system key thing, and add the obfuscation so the administrators can't dump out the SAM. That has the same problem as the master password on Kerberos servers. Somebody has to either simply be there type in the master key, or it has to be stored on the machine someplace, either on floppy or flash.k or whatever, and put it on the Kerberos box. And speaking of Kerberos, NT5 is supposed to have Kerberos 5 support in it. It'll be interesting to see how twisted it becomes. There were incompatible changes Microsoft needed to make to the spec, which were not only fairly hush-hush as to what they were going to be, they were holding up the whole development track for a while. When that finally comes out, well, you can be sure that some people will be ripping into it. So what can you really do to defend yourself? A variety of things. The first thing here is certainly an option. As many of us are forced, try to pack it over as much as you can, not only at your perimeter, but possibly between departments and stuff. Don't let file sharing occur across those borders. The white paper mentioned scope ID. This should actually be on the previous slide, because it really is security for obscurity. It adds some main components that have to match in client-server interactions. I think to the YP domain thing, back in when a lot of people were using YP, but that's really your domain name secret and don't tell anybody. But all the machines in the site have to know this so they can find each other. A scope ID also is visible on the wire and pops right out to say NBPSAT-N or something like that. Not let administrators log in over the network. Use some kind of external logging, such as IDS products like RealSecure or Haystack, whatever. Roll your own with TCP dump and curl script, kind of like Gabriel. I hear good things about that X-ray. Any kind of packet monitor, set up a filter on inbound connections from the outside on 139 and such would help you a lot. And of course, read your logs. Set up some kind of real-time detection if you can. And do your rescue changes and register your file changes. With the caveat that if you take your registry, Microsoft Tech Support may not want to talk to you anymore. I've heard cases of people saying, well, yeah, I changed my registry. And it's like, hello? Well, so what does Microsoft want here? It's unclear, and it's really difficult to get that information out of them. Here's a couple of other random problems that we've seen over time, most of them fairly recently. They don't really relate to SMB, but the legacy code is still part of SMB. It has a stranglehold on the OS, and a lot of it is needed to make any of it work. For instance, getting directory listing is one of those WAN-MAN API things in most cases, to go down the directory and list its elements. MP doesn't really have good user separation. The credentials are based on a UID field in the SMB header, drives that are set up to share and are visible to all users. So one person's Z is also the other person's Z, and it's sort of unclear what the credentials really are at that point. There's a lot of third-party stuff that Microsoft built into MP and 95 that was never really fully tested. It was grabbed off the wherever they got them from and jammed in, and they work. And that and new services that are designed in-house turn up with problems a lot. They probably use common libraries to do a lot of their file I.O. and parsing and whatnot. And some of the problems that have shown up in this, like early IIS, if you handed it a path with ./.. it would just kick over and crash. There was a problem with SAMBA developers. SMB mount to mount an NT box to the Linux file system was they got a few of the fields wrong in some of their interactions and turned out to be blue screening NT boxes. We didn't know why. We've all heard about WinRoot, the out-of-band TCP bug. That should show you this problem. Any kind of unexpected data that you fire into daemons, Portal 135, DNS, several other things, cause them to kick over or drive up CPU usage. And the responses here are often like small incremental fixes where they say, okay, we fixed that problem. And they never say whether they went back to all the other stuff that relates to the same problem and proactively deals with the same fixes to all of those things. Chances are really good that it's not, because it's, again, it's rushed to market. There's a huge amount of past history in the security biz where a lot of problems have turned up and been fixed. General classes of problems, not even specifics. And we seem to not be learning from these things. So, obligatory rant time.
first item here needs clarification. A lot of MC was based on the VMS model, and a lot of the old VMS guys moved over to work on it. Unfortunately, there are a lot of good things about VMS and a lot of bad things. Some of the bad things about VMS is the fact that it had to load up all these dynamic libraries every time we ran a program, all these, like the RMS libraries for file layout and stuff like that. It's taking forever to launch executable, you know, and that was perceived as a problem that a lot of people, the word bloatware wasn't popular back then, but I'm certainly getting there. And one of the good things about VMS, many of the programming interfaces dealt with things like string descriptors, where you have a length count and some attributes and a pointer of where the actual string was. And all of the things you went through to deal with string had to include that length. And if you didn't have the length in the size of the buffer, then it wouldn't work right. So buffer overflows in the VMS environment were highly unlikely. And personally, I never heard of any. Naive crypto usage, you've already seen. Installation procedures, this is kind of mixed. A lot of people say it's easy, some people say it's hard, but apparently if you go to upgrade any other piece of like third-party software, you have to like reinstall service packs, and that's just a pain in the butt. You know, why should we waste all our time doing minor things like that? And again, if you screw up your registry or mess up the file system somehow, the thing won't boot, or will be generally invisible, you have to back up and completely reinstall the OS, and all the third-party stuff, and the service pack. How long is that going to take you for one machine? A really long time. So it should be incrementally fixable.
4 hours if you have a fat CD-ROM.
And the other thing is that minor changes, such as changing an IP address, or just the things that you can do on the fly in the Unix environment, say, you have to restart the machine for this to take effect. Well, what I ask you, what the hell is an OS like that's doing existing in the 90s? Well, it's not existing in the 90s. It's existing in the 80s, from what we can tell, and it's still got a long way to go coming up to speed. Meanwhile, it's being marketed heavily. You can't stop the board juggernaut. and when they try to be tender, they get invasive and flat out dishonest sometimes. Now, to their credit, there are a lot of smart people inside Microsoft. Some of them are actually here. And they know what the problems are. Sometimes we bring them up, and that's the way to hear about it. So, and even in the public disclosures and the public statements that go up on the web servers and stuff, if you read between the lines, it really sounds like there's a lot of puppet strings over whoever actually wrote those pieces of propaganda. The whole thing is being governed by a body of people. And they're not being allowed to, the real people who really know stuff pretty much are not being allowed to talk. So what to poke into next? Well, Mike pointed out a lot of things to go after, and I have a few more here. BDCM application, you already went into. Probably got a good line on that at this point. RAS via network, that port 5678 or whatever it is. That's another avenue in, and it's 139 block, maybe that would work instead. And if you can do that tunneling, then all of a sudden, poof, you're part of the inside network, not part of the outside network. That would be really bad. Way back in 84 or so, the ATM did a survey of sending token random.